I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's been like shooting fish in a barrel to report on problems in the economy. We could do it again today if we wanted. For instance, today, Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke said the recession is turning out to be more severe than he expected. Well, instead, we thought we'd focus today on solutions. For instance, in a few minutes, we'll hear how a community college is scrambling to train workers for the fast-growing wind energy field. And first, how was your commute this morning? Well, here's what it was like for drivers in Los Angeles, as reported on KNX Radio.
All right, you bet. If you're headed for Bob Hope Airport now, this is going to make you late. North 5 and Western, still the two left to back up through Colorado. It's going to be back to Los Feliz before you know it. Off of Colorado, over to...
L.A. was recently named the most congested city in America. The worst time to drive there is now 5 p.m. on a Thursday. An attempt to avoid the Friday glut just moved it back one day. Traffic congestion was actually down 24% in Los Angeles last year and dropped in each of the 20 largest metro areas as people drove less because of high gas prices and unemployment. But city planners aren't relying on the bad economy or gas prices to relieve costly congestion. They're looking at other solutions. John Bruner, an editor at Forbes, has reviewed them. And John, take us through the list. What, first of all, are some of the most congested cities?
Well, up at the top of the list is Los Angeles, as you mentioned, and below that is New York City, Chicago, Dallas, Washington, Houston, San Francisco, Boston, and Seattle. The four most congested cities are also the four most populous cities, though Washington, D.C. is the eighth most populous city and the fifth most congested city.
Right. Well, and in some cases, the congestion in major cities and other cities dropped by huge amounts. For example, I'm looking at Riverside, California. They saw congestion decrease by 57%, Detroit by 47%. So what is the correlation, first of all, between the drop in miles driven and the drop in congestion?
Well, the correlation is remarkable, and what you see in places like Riverside and Detroit is the effects of a pretty profound downturn in the economy, leading people to commute less. Nationwide, Americans drove 3.5% fewer miles in 2008 than they did in 2007. That's a drop from about 3 trillion miles altogether in 2007 to 2.9 trillion in 2008. But the remarkable thing is that that small drop led to an enormous 30% drop in congestion across the country. So the message here is that if you can just get a few people off the road, you can dramatically improve congestion.
It was remarkable. It seems as if it's almost like just getting one, you know, snare out of the gridlock, and then it seems to unlock it. And less congestion means delivery trucks can get to their destinations quicker. People are on time for work and appointments. So less congestion is actually good for the economy.
That's correct. Congestion is enormously costly, and it's built into the price that we pay for just about every good and service. It's something that people don't think about very much, but it's a big part of what we pay for things.
In fact, you've seen the math on what even a little bit of increase in congestion in Los Angeles will do to, jobs. Even just a 10% increase in congestion. Tell us that.
That's right. Some hard numbers on the way that traffic really strangles cities came out in a paper this month in the Journal of Urban Economics, written by a graduate student at the University of California at Irvine named Kent Heimel. He looks at the impact that congestion has on cities and finds that for a city the size of Los Angeles, a 10% increase in congestion would translate into a decrease in long-run employment growth of 4%.
And why is that?
Well, congestion is extremely costly, and it's built into the price for every good and service that we buy. So congestion makes it a lot more expensive to do business. And when it gets really expensive to do business, businesses don't grow.
There you go. And people have to be laid off.
That's correct.
Yeah. Well, and conversely, you don't want to fire or lay off people so they'll drive less. So you have less congestion, which is better for the economy because, of course, laying off people isn't. So how do you transpose some of these findings about congestion to what people should do in the future?
Well, I think the message here is that we need to work on ways to get people to travel outside of the most congested times and outside of the most congested roads. There are a lot of miles of roadway in the country, and only a few of them are congested a few hours of the day, a few days of the week. So we need to look at ways, techniques, policies to get people to travel in ways that cause less congestion.
Well, and there are several approaches being considered here in the Boston area. The governor has suggested a 19-cent gas tax increase to perhaps drive people to public transportation, but to raise money to fix the roads. A group of business leaders here in Boston met, and they said, no, make it 25 cents. You would think that business leaders would want more people to be driving around and shopping and things like that, but they said, no, we do need this money. A Blue Ribbon congressional panel last month recommended that the federal government put in place a temporary 10-cent increase to the federal gas tax, and then shift to a mileage tax, where people are charged about 2 cents for every mile they drive. Now, again, the money collected would go towards rebuilding the roads, but is part of the thinking also that it will impact how much people drive? Because we saw one of the reasons they drove less a year ago was that the gas price was so high.
That's right. The vehicle mile traveled tax is a tricky one, though, because it's not very well targeted. You want to achieve two objectives with good public policy as it relates to traffic. One of them is to get people to use less gasoline, and the other is to get people to drive during off-peak hours or in areas where there's less congestion. The VMT tax does neither of those. It's a broad tax. It is true that it would get people to drive less, generally speaking, but it doesn't target the most congested areas, and it doesn't per se get people to use less gasoline. It just gets them to drive a little bit less.
Right. People would be charged with this extra tax even if they drove on completely empty rural roads.
That's correct.
Yeah. And we should add that President Obama has said he's not in favor of this tax. But let's take a look at some other ideas. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg proposed a congestion charge sort of for the city. People would be charged for going right into the high traffic areas.
That's right. And that's probably a better idea, economically speaking. For every good and service, there's an ideal pricing scheme that maximizes efficiency. If you set a price too low, then demand will outstrip supply. And if you set a price that's too high, then supply will outstrip demand. Hmm. And what is entirely clear here is that free is the wrong price for access to congested urban roadways.
Explain more, because London has a model like this where, you know, if you go into the most congested area, it's not going to be free. So tell us about the London model and what New York proposes to do.
The London model involves paying a charge once you cross a cordon. Effectively, it's an electronic barrier. And when you cross it, you're charged a fee for driving into the city. It's been very successful. Traffic congestion has fallen dramatically. It takes about 40% less time to travel through the city of London. New York proposed a similar charge for driving in Manhattan, but it died in the state legislature last year.
But would this congestion charge unfairly hit commercial drivers? They have to bring things into the city for stores and offices and restaurants. Now, commuters can jump on the Long Island Railroad and they can avoid the congestion charge, but commercial vehicles can't.
Well, it's true that commercial vehicles would have to pay to get on the roads in the city, but they'd be paying for a much better product than what they're getting now. Right now, they're paying nothing, and they're getting stuck in traffic. Under the scheme that was proposed in New York, they would pay a little bit and have clear roads that they could actually transport their goods on in a timely way.
Well, John Bruner, again from Forbes, we want to ask you about one last idea, and then we have someone on the line who's actually doing this in Minneapolis. This is the so-called hot lane. These are the high occupancy lanes that are being turned into toll lanes. It already exists in 5 states in Virginia. They're planning it for the Capitol Beltway and the 395 corridor. Explain how these hot lanes work.
Well, the hot lane is a clever idea that involves a high occupancy vehicle lane, like one that you see in a lot of cities across the country, where you're only allowed to drive in it if your car has a certain number of passengers in it.
And in some cities in the beginning, they were putting blow-up dolls in the passenger seat.
That's right. People kept looking for ways to get around it, and right. I think they still do. Mm-hmm. But this legitimizes one way of getting around it. So what happens now in a hot lane is that if you have fewer than the minimum number of people, you can drive in the lane anyway by paying a charge. And that charge will vary by time of day under some schemes, so that during the more congested times of day, you might pay a charge of up to $20. During less congested times of day, when the advantage of driving in the hot lane is smaller, you'd pay a much, much lower charge.
John Bruner, again, Forbes editor, talking about ways that communities are looking to scale back on congestion, because scaling back on congestion is better for the economy. John, thanks so much.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
Well, the hot lanes have been up and running in Minneapolis for several years. More are being planned. Joining us with more on how they're working, Jim Foti, transportation reporter for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. And Jim, some of us drove on them for the first time when we were in town for the convention last summer. Tell us a little bit about how they're set up, what road, and how they're working.
Well, the road is Interstate 394, which connects downtown Minneapolis with our western suburbs. It's about a 10-mile stretch of road. It opened in 1992 as regular HOV lanes, and then in about 2005, they converted the HOV lanes to the hot lanes. And they did that by adding the electronic tolling mechanism called the MinPass. You drive under the detector with your transponder, and it deducts the amount of the toll. The amount of the toll is set based on how much traffic there is. They update it every few minutes. It can range from 25 cents to off-peak to, they have a maximum of
$8. $8?
Yeah, I've only seen that a few times. On a typical day, it's more like a dollar or two. I guess 10,000 people have the transponders now, but they only use them a couple times a week on average. They kind of price it out. They can make their decision. You know, when they get to the junction, they can say, well, is it worth it to get home a few minutes earlier for $2? Lets people decide when to use it.
In the meantime, I have to say, and for out-of-towners, you're like, what's going on here?
right, yeah. And if you're out-of-towner and you get in the toll lane, there's never a toll booth. You have no cash option. So you may very well get pulled over if you enter the hot lane.
Well, there's a little kink there. But generally, how do people respond? Because when this is being discussed in other cities, people were worried that they're being called Lexus lanes, that these would just be used by people driving a Lexus who could afford it. You know, it would just benefit the wealthy who wouldn't mind paying an extra toll, you know, to get out of the congested traffic.
There was definitely some resistance to the idea when it opened. We don't have any toll roads here in Minnesota, so this was our first modern-day tolling experiment. And the reaction was very skeptical. But recent surveys have shown that it has about a 60 to 75% approval rating by people who use the road. So, you know, the initial reaction was, yes, all these rich people are going to use the lane and I'm going to be stuck here in traffic. But what actually annoys people more is seeing empty pavement right next to them when they're stuck. And so to have the Lexuses out of your way if it's in the other lane, it's increased the capacity of the road by allowing more vehicles into that third or fourth lane. So more vehicles are actually able to use the highway. It's reduced the number of miles that are congested during the peak hours. And they actually have been able to reduce congestion on the regular lanes for the people who aren't paying.
I understand in the beginning there was a lot of empty pavement because people hadn't gotten their cards yet. And so they're sitting in completely backed up traffic and looking over at a completely empty lane. But now does it seem to be evened out? If you were to go there during congested hours, would you see almost as much traffic on the hot lane as on the regular road?
The idea is to keep the hot lane free flowing. And so they do manage it in such a way, they manage the price in such a way that the traffic stays free flowing regardless of what's happening in the other lanes.
Well, so the higher the congestion on the regular lanes, the higher the price to get on the hot lane.
Isn't
that something? Well, it would seem to be a success because we understand Minneapolis is now scheduled to open more hot lanes.
Yeah, thanks to a big federal grant we got to reduce congestion, they're going to open two more lanes to the southern suburbs from downtown Minneapolis later this year. A little bit of a different setup. It's going to be in the left shoulder. They're going to use the left shoulder is going to be a driving lane and a transit lane. We got $133 million from the federal government to do some more experimenting with our congestion relief efforts.
Jim Foti, transportation reporter for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. You can check out his Road Guy blog by going to our website, herenow.org. Jim, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And when we come back, laid-off workers 18 to 48 years old are flocking to a college course to learn how to be wind energy technicians. Can't be afraid of heights. In 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're looking at solutions today. For instance, how to hook up laid-off workers with clean energy companies that desperately need them. Wind turbine maker Vesta Wind Systems announced it will hire nearly 3,000 workers. Aeronautica Wind Power here in Massachusetts hopes to add up to 100 jobs. Well, Saracoso Community College in California City, California, is one of a handful of schools scrambling to retrain workers. They've started an 8-week, $1,700 wind technology boot camp. Larry Board is director, and Larry, this is serious business. Wind towers are from 80 to 400 feet tall. There's high voltage. One of your courses is how to avoid death and dismemberment. Tell us about the 100-foot blades or rotors on top of these turbines.
If you were to take a 747 and tilt it on its side and spin it, that would be what the size of the swept area of a rotor is. Mm-hmm. Now, probably one of the dangerous scenarios is that if we get into what we call a rotor runaway, that can be a serious situation. And people have actually lost their life from it.
Well, and so this is real strict instruction. A GE manager tells the LA Times, you know, it's like working on a school bus on top of a tall pole. It's not some Jiffy Lube job. But what is the pay? I mean, how much can wind turbine workers make?
Well, most of your entry-level technicians start in between $18 to $25 an hour, but there's always room for movement. And if a student is young, doesn't have a family yet, and is willing to travel, they can make anywhere in the neighborhood of about $130,000 to $150,000 a year.
Well, I mentioned GE. After Mesa Lands Community College in New Mexico launched its wind program last fall, GE offered to hire every graduate for 3 years. I know that this kind of news has, you know, been flooding small courses like yours with applicants. Are you surprised at how many people want to be in your course?
Actually, I'm not. We've been just overwhelmed with our website for the college, let alone the phone calls. But people are out of jobs. And you know what? This industry is going to boom here in the next 6 months.
Well, and what kind of industries are students from? I mean, what's the range?
Well, we have quite a few people that are from the construction arena.
Yeah.
Construction here a couple of years ago was thriving. So now things have all come to a halt, and all these people that were involved in the construction area are all looking for jobs.
That's Larry Board, Program Director and an instructor at the Saracoso Community College Wind Technology Boot Camp in California City. Larry, thanks so much.
Hey, it was great talking to you today.
Well, and that brings us to Shane Culleton. He's one of Larry's students at the boot camp. Shane, you are, we understand, a laid-off framer from the construction industry?
Yes, that's correct.
And a 29-year-old father of three. What made you turn to wind power?
Well, I feel like it's going to be around for a while. I don't think it's going anywhere. It's only going to grow, and it seems to be steady.
And what do you think so far about what you're learning? I mean, when we understood that one of the courses was how to avoid death and dismemberment, I mean, this is a serious industry. What was your thinking about that?
It doesn't detour me at all. I come from a construction background, and there's a lot of risks. There's a lot of climbing involved in that. And there's not as much safety involved in that field out here. You know, they don't push it as hard. And in this field, you know, safety is number one. That's the one thing we've learned in every aspect of it.
In wind technology.
Yeah, and as far as I'm concerned, I mean, if someone's paying me to take the safe route and not cut corners, you know, I'd rather come home and see my family at night. So those are the steps that I'll take.
Yeah. What else is appealing to you about wind technology? Have you been up on a tower, or is it all in the classroom now?
I've been out to the field, and I've seen the towers. We haven't gone to climb yet. That's coming up this Friday. I love working outdoors. I mean, just the thought of being up and having a view from 80 to 300 feet is just... it intrigues me.
And what's it like? I mean, how long have you been unemployed?
I've been unemployed for on and off for over a year now, pushing 2 years. It's really hard out here for construction workers right now. I've seen a lot of my supervisors and other people in the field have lost homes, vehicles. You know, it's really tough.
And you've got three kids.
Yes.
Yeah. And what are your fellow students telling you? Because we understand at some of the schools, in an Iowa school, they had a Michigan auto worker, an unemployed Nebraska engineer, you know, a lot of people from different industries. What are you learning about others who are going to these classes with you?
Just similar. You know, economies affected all of them. We have a small business owner there that the value of his business is down. It's not even worth selling it. So he's there to just stay employed. You know, there's a couple of young people that are just interested in coming into the field and starting their careers here.
I'm wondering, Shane, as you position yourself to start in a whole new career, did you used to think about green energy? Did you ever think that you'd be a part of green energy? Did you think it was real?
You know, when the construction industry was booming and I was making decent money, I never thought I'd have to do anything again. I wasn't familiar with the way the economy works. It's been a big lesson, and I had no idea I'd ever come into this field. But I am excited about it. You know, it's nice to think that I'll be working in a field that, I don't know, cares about the environment, I guess you could say.
And is growing.
Yes.
Shane, how much do you hope to make? We hear really good wind technicians can make six figures.
You know, I don't plan on coming into this for a entry-level wind technician position. This is just my foot in the door. I have every intention of finding my way into management, supervisory position. So I'm hoping to get, you know, upwards of 70 to 100,000 in the next 5 years. If not immediately, I'm probably going to opt to travel to take advantage of all the overtime to try and get myself out of the debt I found myself in the last couple of years.
Well, we hope it works out for you for all the reasons that we would, but also because you have vowed that if you don't find the job of your dreams in this new field, you're going to sell your motorcycle.
Yes, I have.
We are rooting for you, Shane.
Thank you.
Shane Cullinan, again, a student at the Cerro Cosa Community College Wind Technology Boot Camp there in California City, California. Shane, thanks so much for speaking with us, and good luck to you.
Okay, thank you.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, is your pension safe? That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, speaking of savings, Bernard Madoff goes to court. After the news, Here and Now. Bernard Madoff left his $7 million Manhattan penthouse where he's been under house arrest and headed to a courthouse where he faces federal charges for running the largest Ponzi scheme in history. It's guaranteed to be a pretty emotional moment if investors show up as well. Madoff has taken to wearing a bulletproof vest. On Thursday, he's expected to plead guilty to bilking investors in a $50 million scam. But will we learn exactly how he did it? Tom Lorisella is covering the story for The Wall Street Journal. And Tom, first to today, what is Madoff expected to say?
Well, today is sort of a technicality of a day. He has to go to court because it turns out that his attorney has some conflicts of interest that need to be dealt with. His attorney, Ira Sorkin, his folks had invested with Bernie Madoff, and Ira has also done some work for Bernie Madoff's sons. So it's sort of a technicality, but you know, it's really sort of gearing up for the big day on Thursday.
Right, and Madoff is expected to say that he's not bothered by those potential conflicts.
That's correct,
right.
Yes.
And so to Thursday, when Madoff is expected to plead guilty, and at least 25 investors have asked to speak. Now, they want prosecutors to spell out exactly how Madoff's scheme, alleged scheme, worked. Can you briefly tick through what they might hear?
Well, it's not clear exactly what they're going to be spelling out. He's expected to plead guilty to sort of a long list of charges that could put him in jail for, you know, a good 30 years or so, probably for the rest of his life. You know, I mean, we have the basic outlines of what happened. We know he sort of fabricated all these statements. They've publicly said it was just a classic Ponzi scheme. He didn't ever make any actual investments over the last decade and a half at least.
Meaning that people who invested late in the game were sort of funding people who invested earlier. It was sort of became a circular thing. He wasn't actually investing in anything outside of his scheme.
That's correct. He never was doing this with this purported strategy that he claimed he was doing. You know, the returns and as well as the investments were just completely fictitious.
Well, when will we start learning how many other people were involved with this? We know that two Madoff clerical assistants told prosecutors they generated fake trading tickets to make it look like Madoff was investing. So how many people knew what was going on?
Well, this has been the question all along. I mean, I think from sort of day one or day two, there was almost nobody who believed Bernie's assertion that was in the original complaint that he did this by himself. You know, what we're going to be waiting to see is to what degree Bernie, as part of his plea deal, has agreed to sort of provide information about the folks who would have had to have helped him or known about it in some fashion. It's not clear we're going to find that out on Thursday. Chances are that the prosecutors are going to be building their case against these other people.
Well, and Madoff's wife, Ruth, has hired her own lawyer and filed papers claiming that $70 million in property and cash is hers and not her husband's. She also took $15.5 million from an account at a firm linked to Madoff Securities in the days running up to her husband's arrest. So how is she expected to fare?
Well, I mean, that's something that in speaking to some of Bernie's investors, they don't buy that this money was not ill-gotten. We've reported that they believe she may have had something to do with moving money around between different accounts. It doesn't necessarily mean that she knew exactly that the whole thing was a fraud, but that there was some involvement on Ruth's part in the scam.
Well, and what about investors themselves? I mean, we're hearing stories of a 90-year-old completely wiped out. He's gone to become a greeter at a supermarket. A couple completely wiped out and stuck in a mobile home in Arizona. They thought they were going to be driving around the country enjoying their retirement. Now they haven't got a penny. I mean, these people are talking about getting money back from Madoff or his wife. But on the other hand, other officials are talking about clawbacks, possibly getting money back from investors, especially early investors, who made money with Madoff. What's the sense of how much money is going to be retrieved?
Well, it's going to be an interesting situation. I mean, the folks who are overseeing the bankruptcy of Bernard Madoff's firm have said that, you know, they're going to be looking at people who pulled out fictitious profits. So if you put in $1 million and took out $2 million, you know, they're going to be looking at that $1 million profit as something that they may go after. They're basically saying it's going to depend. It's not going to be a blanket statement that everybody's profits are going to come back out. But you're right. These weren't all sort of super rich people. It's not clear for some of these folks how much of that money they're ultimately going to recover.
Tom, thank you. Tom Lorisella, a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Okay, we'll be back in half a minute to remind ourselves, why doesn't D.C. have voting rights? You're listening to Here and Now. The license plates in Washington, D.C. carry residents' popular rallying cry, taxation without representation. For decades, Washingtonians have been lobbying for a voting member in Congress. Well, this year they may finally get it. Congress is poised to pass a bill giving the district a seat in the House of Representatives. Right now, they have a non-voting delegate, Eleanor Holmes Norton. Opponents of D.C. voting rights say the Constitution only allows for states to send members to Congress, and since Washington, D.C. is not a state, it's a federal district, it doesn't qualify. So why would the Constitution be written to prevent some Americans from having a voice in Congress? Well, Fergus Bordewick, author of Washington, The Making of the American Capital, says it's because the Founding Fathers made a mistake. Well, Fergus, first of all, why did the Constitution specifically call for federal district, you know, separate from the states, to be the seat of government?
Basically, because we have to remember that the country, then 13 separate states, had very little sense of unity. It was more like Yugoslavia in the 1990s, and the intent was to create a transcendent national symbol, that is the capital, a national capital, that would be a kind of political and aspirational and even spiritual glue for these disparate and often fractious states.
Well, and they were looking to, when the Articles of Confederation were written in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania state politics, you tell us, interfered in that process. So they didn't want state politics to get in the way. By the way, why did they settle on Washington, D.C. as the location for the Capitol?
Well, this was one of the bitterest battles of the early Republic. 32 different sites were proposed, ranging from Kingston, New York, down to Annapolis, Maryland. All these sites had their partisans. But it wound up on the Potomac because of the politics of slavery. That's to say, there was a very strong lobby from the southern states to place the capital where it would be safe within the slave states. They didn't want freedom to be the national paradigm, which would have been the case in the free state of Pennsylvania. The other reason is that the granddaddy of all political deals was cut in Thomas Jefferson's back room, literally, when the Capitol was in New York and Thomas Jefferson's home. Hamilton, Jefferson, and Madison sat around a table. Hamilton, an abolitionist, traded votes he had in Congress to the South for Southern capital. In return, Southerners very grudgingly traded a few votes for Hamilton's financial plan, which created the basis of our present financial system.
Well, and it's just fun to know that the Washington was based on a backroom deal. It's sort of like, and it continued for the next, you know, couple hundred years. Well, what was there in Washington at the time the Capitol was set up there?
Well, it's a myth that it was a swamp. It wasn't a swamp. It was farmland, primarily, occupied by plantations that used slave labor. And there was the small town of Georgetown, which, of course, is still there. So it was empty land, essentially. And this is one of the very first instances in the modern world of a nation creating a city out of nothing.
Well, and the fact that the area where the capital was built was so empty, so few people lived there, might have been behind the reasoning that they didn't have a vote. I mean, did they not foresee that there'd be a huge permanent population moving in there?
Well, in point of fact, there was no original intention to deprive the people of the federal district, as it was called, of a vote. It really was a genuine oversight, and indeed Alexander Hamilton pointed out the oversight at the beginning, but Congress never really got around to remedying it. And because the federal district didn't have many people in it, there really wasn't much of a local lobby for it. But that said, people living on the Maryland side of the Potomac in the district voted in Maryland elections in the 1790s. Those on the Virginia side voted in Virginia elections. And it wasn't until a bit later that people really lost the ability to vote.
And what happened at that time to change it? I mean, why did somebody suddenly decide that people who live on either side of the Potomac, in the shadow of the Capitol, couldn't vote in Maryland or Virginia?
The Capitol was established in 1791, and in 1801, Washington was incorporated, and people who lived in the district at that point ceased being residents of Maryland and Virginia. And people in Alexandria, on the Virginia side, protested vigorously right from that moment on that they had been deprived of their vote. One of the great jurists of the time, Edmund Pendleton, a Virginian, said that the omission made slaves of the residents of the district and that it was antithetical to Republican values.
Well, fast forward to today, when opponents of D.C. voting rights make the argument that the Constitution deprives them, it sounds like you're saying that it was really kind of a mistake.
It was a mistake. It was an oversight. The founders dropped the ball on this.
And has it been just a political football ever since? I mean, we've had Republicans in power for the last 8 years. It's a largely Democratic constituency that lives in the shadow of the Capitol. Has it just been a political football, and is it now being tossed, you know, to a democratically led Congress that might give the district voting rights?
Well, unpleasant as this is, I think the root problem here for many years has as much to do with racism as it does with partisan politics, in that the great majority of residents of the district happen to be African American. There were political constituencies in this country which for many years really didn't want a largely African American entity to have its own congressman. In addition, as you pointed out, it is so heavily Democratic that that congressman or woman will be a Democrat. But the deal that is currently in the works would give Utah, one of the most staunchly Republican states in the country, an additional congressperson as well, and that individual is highly likely to be a Republican in order to balance the district.
To balance it out. Well, putting all that aside, what do you think the Founding Fathers would have thought of all of this?
Well, on one hand, I think they would be heartened to see Americans still vigorously and tenaciously debating issues like proper representation and voting and so on, and be immensely relieved that the invention that they produced 200 years ago is still functioning this well. I think they also would be perhaps extremely annoyed that it has taken 200 years to remedy this oversight.
Fergus Bordewick, author of Washington, The Making of the American Capital. Fergus, thanks so much.
Well, thank you so much, Robin. It's been a pleasure.
Well, we have a few minutes now for some of your thoughts. Richard Kruger of Mansfield, Massachusetts, really appreciated our tour with historian Doris Kearns Goodwin of FDR's old college suite at Harvard. But Richard writes, FDR should also be called to task for what he didn't do. He was shown incontrovertible evidence of the Holocaust and did little to publicize it or take the necessary steps to bomb the rail links to the camps. My only point here is that all people should be judged on the totality of their actions, good and bad. Dr. Edwin Stickney of Billings, Montana, wrote, after our conversation with Sam Kanonis of the Los Angeles Times about the hundreds of ransom kidnappings in Phoenix, Arizona, directly connected to the drug wars in Mexico. Ed blasted the illegal drug use in the U.S. that's fueling those wars in Mexico, but he also blasted the drug laws here that criminalize some drugs. He writes, I've personally issued recommendations to more than 60 patients, allowing them to get medical marijuana cards to eliminate the need for narcotics to treat pain, or in the case of cancer patients, the effects of chemotherapy. When will we come to our senses and reverse our harmful policies? And finally, we heard from Amy Carroll after yesterday's story about the thousands of idled freight cars parked on rails across the country because of the lack of goods to move. Amy writes, my husband and I traveled to my hometown in rural Kentucky over the holidays and saw the same phenomenon, a very obvious and sad reminder of the economy. But they were also kind of beautiful, tracing the lines of the rolling hills that I love. My dad tells me there are about 7 miles of train cars in the area surrounding my town. Hope you enjoy my photos, and thanks for your show. Well, Amy, thanks for your photos. They'll be at our website, where anyone can click on Contact Us and send an email or a photo. That's hereandnow.org. We'll be back in a minute. Here and Now. Welcome back to Here and Now. And question for you. Is it ever wrong to do the right thing? Residents of New York Mills, Minnesota, hope you give that some thought. There's one school in New York Mills, two bars, no traffic lights. Folks drive 30 miles to get to the nearest mall. But for the 17th year in a row, this farming town of 1,200 is hosting a philosophy contest called the Great American Think-Off, which Americans from around the world can enter in hopes of being named America's Greatest Thinker. This year's question, is it ever wrong to do the right thing? Two townspeople from New York Mills, Minnesota, join us to talk about the contest. Jamie Robertson is the director of the New York Mills Regional Cultural Center. Jamie, welcome.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And your group hosts the event, while Mike Parda is a longtime supporter of the Regional Cultural Center. Mike, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
And let's start with you, Mike. Why does a town, how did a town with only 1,200 people come up with the idea of holding an annual philosophy contest?
Sometimes you just have to be lucky, and that's the way fate runs. But we had an individual move to town who was very creative in the arts, and he had this idea of creating the cultural center in New York Mills, and he decided that we needed to get people, ordinary people, involved in great activities. And he created the Great American Think-Off, or a philosophy contest for the common man, and it is just exploded over the years.
Well, we don't mean to imply, by the way, that, you know, people who are in a small farming community aren't having deep thoughts and sitting around probably having more conversations and more thoughtful conversations, than their counterparts, staring at their iPhones, at Starbucks in big cities. But how did people react to the idea of a philosophy contest?
Well, everybody thought that his name was John Davis, and everybody thought that John had probably sat in the snowbank a little bit too long and he had frozen his brain. As we started talking about it and realizing our farmers do a lot of thinking as they're plowing their fields and sitting in that tractor cab,
right,
and other people do as well. And it just kind of caught on. And there were people who said it couldn't be done, it couldn't be done. But within 4 or 5 years, we were on C-SPAN with it. So it's been amazing.
And as we said, people enter from across the country. Four finalists are selected to participate in a debate right there in town in front of a live audience, and the audience votes on the winner. Jamie, as we said, the question this year, is it ever wrong to do the right thing? How did you come up with the question?
Well, every year a group of folks from the region get together and put on their thinking caps and start concocting an essay topic. Last year the question was, does immigration strengthen or threaten the United States? And so we kind of alternate. Sometimes there are specific kinds of questions like that one, and other times they're more open-ended, as this one is.
Right. Well, and how many submissions? Let's take last year, for example. How many submissions did you get?
Around 300 last year, and then we get anywhere from 300 to 500 submissions annually.
Well, and who are they from?
They're from folks working at Harley-Davidson plants, and from ministers and doctors and lawyers and teachers, and from students and everyday folks. Not very many, none, I don't think, really, from philosophy professors.
I was going to ask, do you consult professional philosophers or professors in coming up with the questions? Do you consult them, in shaping the event at all? Or
we do, in the sense that after we have concluded on a set of possible questions for the year, we submit those to a philosophy professor at the University of Minnesota and ask him to give his advice about wording and about what kinds of problems we might encounter with one or another of them.
Yeah, unforeseen, yeah.
Right.
Well, then we understand the four finalists, if they're not already from New York Mills, get an all-expense-paid trip to New York Mills and as we said, appear in front of the town. Mike, what's that like on the day that this happens? We understand the 500-seat school auditorium is filled.
Right. When it was originally started, it was held in the school gymnasium because we didn't have an auditorium. And it was much like an athletic event, a very festive-type atmosphere. Now that's in our new auditorium, and we pretty much fill up the place. The interesting part about it is that during the intermissions, you'll overhear people debating the question among themselves in the group.
Well, and I understand, you know, I want you to reflect on some of your favorite moments past, because I understand that sometimes, and again, mostly in the audience, you have people from New York Mills, they've been swayed on issues. Give us some examples.
Well, I think a real interesting one was a question that we just had a few years ago on should same-sex marriages be prohibited? And being from a rural small town, I think the common feeling was that they probably should be. As people were listening to the debates, one of the individuals who was in favor of same-sex marriages presented many aspects to that and picked people's curiosity, and before the evening was over, he was voted the winner. And so the group supported same-sex marriage.
Which probably surprised them.
Oh, it was very surprising.
Well, and one of the early questions we understand, and this is on your website, are humans inherently good or inherently evil? We understand.
That was actually the very first question.
Ah, and you had a priest, a newspaper editor, a 15-year-old cheerleader, and a former tribal police officer.
Yes, interestingly enough, if I remember correctly, it was the newspaper editor who won. Yeah.
But we understand it was pretty close.
Yes, it was. Yeah. It was. And the discussion among the group gets rather heated at times. And this is one of them where people really kind of squared off with each other and debated it amongst themselves.
That's Mike Pardee. He's a longtime New York Mills resident and supporter of the town's cultural center, which every year holds its Great American Think-Off Contest. You can participate right now. You can go to our website, herenow.org, and we'll link you up. Jamie Robertson, the director of the New York Mills Regional Cultural Center, which is behind this fascinating contest. Again, this year's question is it ever wrong to do the right thing? How are the entries so far, Jamie?
They're coming in fast this year. It's really been an interesting year. And I just to kind of support something that Mike was just saying, too, and that is that it's kind of amazing for any group of people anywhere in the United States to be able to go in and sit on a June evening and listen for 2 hours to a philosophy debate like this and find the whole audience completely engaged in that debate. It was really quite a remarkable event.
Yeah, and it's really thoughtful. It's not Chris Matthews and somebody else yelling at each other.
Right.
But you only have till April 1st to enter. Jamie, Mike, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you, Robin.